From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
My phone interview a month ago with Anthony Shadid from Tar, Lebanon, was cut short when a bomb exploded much too close to him, and I've been worried about him ever since. As a Pulitzer Prize-winning Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, he's no stranger to the dangers of war. He documented some of his earlier experiences during the 2003 invasion of Iraq in his book Night Draws Near, which is now available in a paperback edition from Picador. And he's recently returned from Lebanon. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
I'm so relieved to know that you're back and unscathed. When did you return?
You know, I got back, I guess, about a week ago now, 5 days ago. I was in Washington for a little while now. With family in Oklahoma.
And we discussed the last time your personal connection to the story, your Lebanese parents. In Oklahoma, how many Lebanese immigrants wound up in Oklahoma?
You know, it's a surprising number, actually. I grew up in Oklahoma City, where there was probably 100 families, all from the same village in Lebanon, actually. Most, probably five different last names, but they all did trace their origins back to the same community in Lebanon.
Can you remind us what happened when you were last on the show? That was July 26, just about a month ago.
Right. We were in Tyre, and we were talking at a bomb scene that had gone off in the late evening. Actually, I think it was two or three bombs that had struck a neighborhood where a Hezbollah leader was believed to have resided. And the bombs probably, you know, they went off probably about 100 meters from where we were talking.
What were you doing there?
I was reporting it, basically. I'd just gone to the scene to find out what had happened. But it's one of those, you know, one of the most dangerous things I think you do in some of those situations is perhaps get there too soon, when emotions are really high, when people want to vent their frustrations. And that was kind of one of those scenes where there was a lot of desperation, a lot of uncertainty, people not knowing what to do or where to go. And we kind of ended up talking in the middle of that.
And how long do you stay in a situation like that? Do you start sending back reports immediately, or do you hang around and try to see how the thing transpires?
You know, the business is changing a little bit, even for foreign correspondents, I think. You know, more and more these days, you do have to call your office pretty quickly because of the web, because of the Internet, trying to update stories as rapidly as possible. Now, this is a story that might not have needed to be updated all that quickly, and I'm not sure if I even called my newspaper right away on this. So then you do the more traditional approach to reporting, which is basically spend as much time as you think you need to have a sense of it, to be able to write the story with some authority, to get a sense of the extent of the damage, of the injuries, the voices that you hear there on the ground of what happened and what might happen next. I think I ended up spending probably a couple of hours. We were dealing with another limitation there at the time, which was it was getting dark, basically, and you don't want to be outside after dark, especially in a situation like that. So I think that was probably a decision most of the journalists who were there that night left, because it was just getting dark and it wasn't safe to be on the roads.
How do you send back reports? With a BlackBerry, a cell phone, or do you have Internet access?
You know, it's one of the wonders of technology these days. I mean, when I started doing, reporting overseas, this is back in 1995, we used to use satellite phones that were the size of trunks, basically. I mean, they were very big devices, and you couldn't carry them from place to place. You basically set them up in one place and left them, and you would have to go back to that location to file a story. These are in places where you wouldn't have phone lines. I think that was actually Afghanistan, where we had that satellite phone that was so big. These days, the satellite phone is the size of it's actually smaller than a laptop, and you just carry it with your laptop, and it has a battery, so you can charge it. You can pretty much set it up anywhere, and it's almost high-speed Internet connection once you do set it up. So these kind of logistics of reporting in these situations has become much easier. That used to tell friends that it was sometimes 60 or 70% of the job was just the logistics, making sure you had the battery, making sure you had electricity, some kind of phone connection. these days it's gone far down. I mean, it really is. It's almost, in some, if your equipment is working right, it's almost an afterthought.
You've said in interviews that it was very difficult to get around Lebanon. In fact, you found an interesting guy, Abu Hussein, an out-of-work communist dentist who was willing to drive you around, and he was charging you $500 a day? That doesn't sound very... That sounds more capitalist than communist to me.
I think he insisted he was giving the money to the families who were in need, and I wanted to believe him, so I didn't ask too many questions about it. But he stayed with me the first week. At one point, he got a little upset. He didn't want to go to some of the places I wanted to go, so he threatened to take my father's phone number and call him and tell him what I was doing. I said, you know, I don't think that's a good idea right now. After Abu Hassan kind of went off and did his own thing, we went and did. We were actually, it was often journalists getting together into convoys and kind of doing their own, taking their own cars. It was tough. It was tough to get people who were willing to go to some of these places. And it wasn't that you knew that there was necessarily danger where you were going, but it was more there was an insecurity on the roads in those days. There was a lot of Israeli aircraft in the sky, and cars had been targeted. Our cars had been hit, I should say. And that was, I think, the biggest concern for us in trying to decide where to go and how to go.
Well, how do you even drive around on roads that have, and bridges that have been bombed?
Exactly. It became extremely difficult. I remember there was one trip that I was trying to take. It was, you know, maybe a 10-minute drive outside of Tyre. It was to a place kind of in the mountainous hinterland, but a very straight shot. And when Abu Hassan and I tried to drive that, I think it took us 2 or 3 hours, and we ended up going, instead of, it was probably, you know, 10 kilometers, it became more than 100 kilometers. Just trying, you would hit a crater, you would take another road, you would hit a bombed-out road, you'd have taken another kind of side route. Some just felt too dangerous. You were the only car on the road at that time, so you were reluctant to spend too much time there.
And I gather that some Lebanese civilians would ask you for a ride because they were concerned about family members.
They did, and that was something I'd never experienced that, I guess, as a reporter, the degree to which reporters in some ways, and it was a very sad statement about the situation, but that reporters became the only semblance of, I don't want to say authority, that's not the right word, but of an organized institution in some respects. I mean, the Lebanese government, which has never had a very big presence in southern Lebanon, but in the days of the war, it had virtually no presence. Hezbollah was still there, and they do run a state within a state in southern Lebanon, and they maintained some sort of infrastructure. But beyond that, it was really the Red Cross and journalists who were often the only people in these towns. And you would find that very often, people asking reporters for help. Can you get us a ride out? Can you check on our house for us? Very rarely would people ask for money. I think that would be too humiliating. And you find the people in southern Lebanon, you know, pretty proud people. But in terms of trying to get help, just get out of there, especially when drivers who would dare do the roads were charging $500,000 to go, you did hear these requests and, you know, made more and more often.
So reporters became part of the humanitarian relief system there.
Well, there was only so much you could do as a reporter, too. I mean, we were driving in a small car. We did at one point give a couple of people a ride out of a place called Ramesh down to Tyre, but I think that was the only time that it actually happened, just because we often had equipment or the car was too small. And, it was frustrating, I think, as you don't lose your humanity as a reporter, and so you always have to make these choices of what you can and what you can't do. And I'd never run into choices like that, to be honest, as a journalist.
My guest is Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post. A listener asks, didn't the decades-long Lebanese civil war end just 6 years ago? Are you certain that all the destruction you saw was caused by the Israelis in 34 days?
Well, the Lebanese civil war actually ended 16 years ago. It ended in 1990. I think what the caller is referring to is the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, which did end in 2000, which was 6 years ago. That occupation wasn't, I mean, the destruction that would have come from that occupation, there were two very large-scale Israeli campaigns in 93 and 96, and there was destruction, but they paled before what happened in this war. And it was pretty clear. I mean, I had traveled in southern Lebanon quite a bit. My family's ancestral village is in southern Lebanon. And, I mean, the destruction we saw is very clearly from this past month.
Some people have become suspicious because of the doctored photographs that Reuters published recently, and there have been accusations of some other photographs that have also been doctored or mislabeled.
Right, and I had heard a little bit about that. To be honest, you know, you're kind of in a bubble down there when you're reporting on the story. I'd heard that there were suspicions surrounding the sequence of events or the photographs that came out of Qana. Now, Qana is that village outside of Tyre where the Lebanese government initially put the casualty figure at more than 50 dead. It was later turned out to be 27 dead, or 28 dead, if I recall. I didn't quite understand. I was there at Kana when bodies were being taken out, and I mean, there was, you know, from what I saw, there's the idea that it was set up or the idea that it was somehow fabricated just isn't possible. Photographs would be a different story. I just don't know.
What happened in the photographs is that a man was identified as dead, and then we see a later photograph with him walking around.
Oh, is that right?
The photographs that Reuters published showed much more enhanced smoke rising from Beirut, and it was obvious that it had been drawn in. Uh-huh. There was another case of a woman who whose image appears in two very different photographs taking place at very different times, but it's the exact same woman. So these are things that have made people a little suspicious.
Right, and it's kind of amazing. I mean, given the scale of what, you know, of what I saw down there over those weeks, that you would need to doctor a photograph or somehow to dramatize what happened. It's almost bizarre. I mean, this was a pretty devastating 34 days. I mean, as you know, as I'm sure people living in northern Israel might have thought, as the rockets rained down there too. But I'm speaking for southern Lebanon, where I was working, and it was a devastating few weeks. I mean, the scale of the damage in Bente Jebel, for instance, which is a town near the Israeli border, the damage I saw there was, you know, I'd seen Fallujah, I'd seen other places that paled before that. I mean, there was parts of that village that just no longer exist.
Did you travel with a photographer?
I did. Michael Robinson Chavez, who was a Washington Post photographer, was with me for the first half of it, and then he thought he was going to have to go to Cuba when Fidel Castro entered the hospital, so he left about halfway through. But for the first 2 weeks, he was with me entire.
That says something about modern journalism as well, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
You just parachute into each crisis situation.
And I think especially with photographers, because, I mean, basically there are fewer of them, and their resources are stretched a little thinner. That was, you know, I was actually based in Beirut, which was, I guess, a good thing in the sense that, you know, I was there, was able to be there on the first day when this happened. And it became a challenge, I think, for a lot of journalists trying to get in and out of Lebanon once the airport was closed. There was probably a 36-48-hour window there, a very crucial 36 or 48 hours when it became difficult or somewhat unsure on how you're going to enter Beirut. Most people did manage eventually to get Syrian visas and enter by road from Damascus, but it was a hassle.
Well, you talk about the resilience of the Lebanese people and how they reorganized their lives to survive during the conflict. Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, I'm always struck by that, and it's something that I saw in Iraq as well, is that even in the bleakest circumstances, there is a certain resilience, and it's almost I think it's one of the best human qualities, that you can face these incredible bleak conditions, incredibly bleak circumstances, and somehow make sense of them, or maybe not make sense of them necessarily, but somehow endure them, and endure them with a certain decency, with a certain life just doesn't fall apart. And I noticed that. There was this one time I was trying to go, again with Abu Hassan, the driver, to a place called Srifa, and there had been a report of, nobody knew for sure, but the Red Cross was saying anywhere from 60 to 80 people have been killed in this village under, there was an Israeli airstrike on the village and the buildings had collapsed, and you know, you didn't want to rely on numbers like that, so I was trying to go there myself to find out what happened. Abu Hassan and I went there. This is actually the same trip we were speaking about earlier, and we just couldn't, in the end, get there. There was too much shelling going on over the village, so we stopped and we were about to have to turn back. And as we were turning back, I saw a person standing in the street and started speaking to him, and I asked him where everybody had gone, and he said, well, they're all hiding in the shelter. It was basically the basement of a villa, and I went over to the basement, and it was a chilling scene. It was a remarkable scene and chilling at the same time, because there were scores of people hiding in what was basically a dark garage, but within that garage they had created their own, or tried to reestablish their own community in a way that people were taking turns cooking food, cleaning, taking out the trash. I mean, within just probably 2 days, a new community had been established, and it did strike me that how you do see that resilience, and how you do see that, you know, I think in the most uncertain times, people look for any kind of certainty, and certainty often comes from routine, and that routine is a way to get through, you know, conditions that I think those people feared could go on and on, weeks and weeks.
My guest is Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post. His book, Night Draws Near, has just been made available in a paperback edition from Picador. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post. His book, Night Draws Near, which is about the invasion of Iraq in 2003, is now available in a paperback edition from Picador. Anthony, in the New York Times lead story today about the two Fox reporters being released by kidnappers in Gaza, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, is quoted as saying that Hezbollah would ignore what he called Israel's provocations and that Hezbollah had not expected even 1% of Israel's response to its July 12th cross-border raid. And then he said, if I had known that the operation to capture the soldiers would lead to this result, we would not have carried it out. Do you think that's a sincere expression of regret?
I actually do. I think that Hezbollah was taken by surprise by the scope of the Israeli response. Now, there's no question that one of Hezbollah's very reasons to have arms these days, in its own self-narrative, the only way that it describes its own actions, its own ideology, is this idea of defending southern Lebanon. Hezbollah talks about this. They go to very great lengths talking about this. That means they have been preparing for something like this, and they've spent the past 6 years preparing for what they expected would be an Israeli campaign. But did they expect what happened when it happened? And I think that it's clearly they did not. And you'd heard this from Hezbollah officials during the war, that they were taken by surprise. And, you know, I know how do you define winners or losers? I mean, that's always a matter of interpretation. But I think to Hezbollah, their survival was in their own eyes, a certain victory. But it was a costly victory. And there's no question they lost probably hundreds of their fighters. They lost a lot of their weapons. They returned to a Lebanese political landscape that is very unsettled at best, is very precarious, and the fallout hasn't settled from this war. So, you know, did Hezbollah expect this to turn out the way it did? I don't think they did at all. And I think they expected 2 or 3 days of Israeli retaliation, bombing of some bridges and roads, and then this would be lead to negotiations over these captured soldiers and the Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails. It didn't turn out that way. And I think what you're hearing from Nasrallah is something that I think he is speaking somewhat sincerely.
And there are many people in Israel who are unhappy with the whole way the thing was conducted and the lack of preparation there. So this is something that just seems to me got out of hand.
Yeah, it was interesting. I think for a lot of journalists who are sitting there the first few days, when you heard the statements being made, this idea that Hezbollah is going to be dismantled or Hezbollah is going to be disarmed, I think anybody who'd spent time in Lebanon or who had some sense of the organization knew that it's hard to imagine how that would be carried out by arms. And I think once you heard those statements being made, you almost had a sense that the goals were being set so high, or the ideas of what would come out of this war were being set so high that it was either going to go on for a long, long time or people were going to have to scale back and have to scale their ambitions back. And I think that's what happened in the end. It did go on much longer than people thought, and in the end that people did scale their ambitions back to the point where I think what you see in Lebanon today is pretty much the status quo ante, with the exception of a lot more international soldiers on the southern border. But Hezbollah does still exist. If anything, it's stronger in terms of Lebanese politics. Like I said, the Lebanese political landscape is unsettled, but it's always been unsettled. And you do wonder what the long-term, how is history going to be written about this conflict? I think that's really unclear still at this point.
Well, how much of this is about Lebanese politics and Israeli politics? For example, Olmert, some people say, responded with such force to secure his position because he has no military background, even though he inherited his job from Ariel Sharon, who obviously did.
You know, and I hesitate to speak too much about Israeli politics because it's been a few years since I've been there, and I definitely haven't done all that much reporting on the scene. I think, but when we do speak about, I think I think Israel may sense a danger over the way this war went, in the sense that Israel has often, I think in the rest of the region, Israel has a certain military prowess that people are very aware of in the Middle East. And I think that military prowess took a beating. Or the image of that military prowess, the perception of that military prowess, took a beating during this war. Like I pointed out, in the calculus you often see of politics in the Middle East, survival does mean victory. Saddam Hussein was able to claim victory by surviving the Gulf War, I think in much clearer ways over this past conflict with Hezbollah. If they were still there, if they still had their arms, they could claim a victory. And I think what you saw in the days and weeks after the ceasefire within Israeli public discourse as well was there was a sense that this war did not go the way they wanted it to. That it was undecided at best, and when these conflicts are undecided, perceptions become paramount. And I think there is a perception out there that Hezbollah, in their eyes at least, did did as they wanted to do, in the sense that they did survive and that they did in some ways bolster their standing. So I think we are going to see a certain shift in sentiments, a certain shift in perceptions in the region over this relationship of Israel to its neighbors and also Israel to actors like Hamas and Hezbollah.
The American press has been reporting that the high number of Lebanese civilian casualties was due in great measure to Hezbollah's tactic of integrating weapons and fighters in with ordinary citizens. Is that something you witnessed?
You know, there was something that I think, and I was talking to some of the human rights activists or people involved in trying to monitor the stuff going on in Lebanon, because there was the contention that villagers were being used as effective human shields for some of this. It's a very hard, I think sometimes definitions it's hard to, how do I put this? Understanding Hezbollah's relationship to southern Lebanon blurs some of these definitions in a way. And it's a remarkable relationship. And I don't want to sugarcoat the movement by any means. I mean, it has a long record. I mean, you know, we have to remember that it was involved. It was a very different organization back in the early 80s, but that organization that did exist back then was responsible for the bombing of the Marine barracks and the twice bombing of the U.S. Embassy. Like I said, it's a very different organization today. But when we talk about its relationship to southern Lebanon itself, it's a very organic relationship. It's a movement that is probably, it's hardly ever perceived in Lebanon as a terrorist movement. It's perceived more as a political movement, a social welfare movement, or a very highly trained armed militia. And I think that relationship is especially pronounced in southern Lebanon, where the people went through the Israeli occupation for 18 years. To distinguish Hezbollah sometimes from the people that it lives among is very difficult. And I saw that on display the day after the ceasefire. One of these fighters had returned, and within 24 hours he'd become a relief worker. I saw how he was greeted by people in the village. It was, like I said, a very organic relationship. So I guess it's a long way of getting around to saying, was Hezbollah forcing people or intimidating people to let them hide the weapons there? I doubt it. I suspect that, you know, the fighters were often people who came from the village itself. And the line of, you know, where does Hezbollah end and where does it begin is sometimes very hard to pinpoint.
So claims of civilian casualties might also be blurred because some of them might have in some way been working with Hezbollah. This is Hezbollah's approach has been similar to what Hamas has done, establishing a base of support by mixing social welfare with military activities.
Definitely. It's a standard of Islamic activism in the Middle East. You see it time and again, from Egypt to the Palestinian territories, to Lebanon, to Jordan. I mean, it is very much this, you know, it's a kind of a melding of politics and welfare that began with the left, actually, in the Middle East, but it's very much become a trademark of Islamic activists. But when you go back to this point, I mean, about civilians, you know, it's in a way what was going on in southern Lebanon, in a way, was a guerrilla conflict. And I think that's, you know, it's not a question that we're asking only about Lebanon. It's, you know, to what degree are people considered combatants, and to what degree does support for a guerrilla movement then make them targets, basically? And I think that question hasn't been answered, and I think that's what we saw exactly happening in southern Lebanon, because there were a great number of civilian deaths. And, you know, you saw at these bombings there were women and children who were killed. You know, did they support Hezbollah? Perhaps. Does that then make them a target? You know, maybe that's a question for somebody other than a journalist to answer. There was a great deal of suffering down there in southern Lebanon.
My guest is Anthony Shadid, who has just returned from covering the war in Lebanon. He also has just recently had his book, Night Draws Near, made available in paperback from Picador. It was in hardcover last year, and it covers the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Well, the whole business of Hezbollah is a social welfare group is of concern to Israel as well. Defense Minister Amir Peretz told the Israeli cabinet that he's nervous that Hezbollah's highly organized aid efforts will further endear them to the Lebanese people.
I think that, you know, again, like I was pointing out, I mean, when in southern Lebanon, well, you know, there is a question to ask down the road in the months from now. I mean, I think emotions are still running very high right now in the wake of this conflict. In months from now, is there going to be fallout among Hezbollah's Shiite Muslim constituency over the damage and over the price they had to pay in this war? That's possible. But I think when you're talking about right now, that bond between Hezbollah and its Shiite Muslim constituency is unbroken, and if anything, I think strengthened at this point. Obviously, the reconstruction is going to be a huge test, and Hezbollah understood that. And I think within 24 hours of the ceasefire, Hassan Nasrallah, the Hezbollah leader, went on television and said, we're going to rebuild. And And I think people perceive them as being much more efficient, much more organized, much less corrupt than the Lebanese government, and they probably would prefer them to take the leadership in the reconstruction.
I saw an article comparing what Hezbollah has been doing to what the United States government did in New Orleans, and we came out looking a lot worse.
It's, you know, we're talking about an organization, whatever your political perspective on them, but an organization that is highly organized, probably the most organized movement I've ever seen in the Middle East. And within 24 hours, I was in a village in southern Lebanon called Khiam. Within 24 hours, there were six or seven bulldozers in the street clearing the rubble. They had formed a 10-member committee that was surveying not only each house in the village itself, but each house in the surrounding area as well. Trucks were plying the roads with food and water. I mean, this is 24 hours after the ceasefire. It knows that it, you know, its constituency paid during this conflict, and that it's got to offer some kind of compensation to that constituency, because without that constituency, it's no longer a movement. I mean, it really does. It is a player. It has its place in Lebanese politics because it can claim to represent the single largest community in the country, and it needs to do everything it can to keep that bond. And you know, from the early signs, it's fully aware of that.
Well, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait were both critical of Hezbollah's kidnapping of the Israeli soldiers, and now Saudi Arabia has promised $1.5 billion for reconstruction. Kuwait has offered $300 million. Does this suggest a blurring of the Shiite-Sunni lines in the Middle East?
Well, to me, in fact, I think it suggests the opposite. It actually shows how these Shiite-Sunni tensions, which have become much greater in recent years, is starting to play out in kind of a regional level. There is a deep suspicion on the part of Saudi Arabia, on the part of Egypt, Kuwait to a lesser degree, and Jordan to a lesser degree, but there is a great deal of suspicion on the part of these Sunni-dominated regimes over Hezbollah and over Hezbollah's perspective, their ties to Iran, what those ties with Iran mean for Arab and Middle Eastern politics. I think we're starting to see what was once in some ways a localized conflict, like Shiite-Sunni tension, for instance, in Iraq, or Shiite-Sunni tension in Lebanon. Now we're starting to see it play out across the region, and it's something that is definitely not. I mean, it's going to go on, and I think we're seeing this across the Arab world in a way, is that there is a certain death of ideology. Ideologies that propelled politics in the Arab world for a generation just are no longer there. They no longer have the resonance they once did. And I think you are starting to see identity, this question of who we are, how we represent ourselves. It revolves more and more around these questions of sect and ethnicity. Are we Sunni? Are we Shiite? Are we Christian? And even if we're Christian, are we Orthodox? Are we Maronite? I think you are starting to see those identities much more pronounced, and in much more pronounced ways they're shaping the politics of those countries.
But at the same time, we have Hezbollah being given arms by Syria, which is a Sunni-majority country, and Iran, which is pretty much dominated by Shiites.
But Syria is a special case, though. I mean, Syria, as you pointed out, is a Sunni-majority country, but its government represents a smaller sect known as the Alawites. And the Alawites are, I don't know if you want to describe them as an offshoot or they trace their origins back to Shiite Islam, but there is a connection between Shiite Islam and the Alawite sect to one point where a Lebanese cleric in the 70s actually acknowledged it as a part of Shiite Islam. So Syria definitely is not part of that kind of Sunni, how would you call it, a Sunni establishment or Sunni establishment politics in the Arab world, because it does represent a minority, and a minority that is non-Sunni. The government.
In Night Draws Near, you asked, how does a journalist convey the ferocity of violence without losing meaning in a mind-numbing array of adjectives? And then, how does one cover war from a professional distance when, as someone reporting from a city under siege, one has no distance? Have you come up with any answers?
You know, I haven't. And I found this past month frustrating, on some levels, because I don't, I was telling actually some family that I was talking to the other day, I don't enjoy covering conflict or war, however you describe it. I find it hard to write stories that become meaningful or that have any kind of resonance, because as I wrote in Night Draws Near, there is a certain repetition to it. There's a certain I don't want to say banality, because there's an incredible degree of tragedy and suffering that happens in these conflicts. But I think as a reporter trying to make sense of it all with our limited means and our limited time, it's very difficult, and the only way I've been able to figure out a way to deal with that is just to focus on the lives themselves and to try to treat war as a backdrop. That war is a backdrop to this, to lives playing out on the ground, lives in very difficult circumstances, and to try to understand those human qualities that do shine through in these conditions. it's much easier to talk about than to actually do it, I found. And I think this war was by far the most, I mean, to me at least, it was the most difficult that I've covered over the past 10 years.
And does this mean that you don't want to go back to conflict zones?
You know, I live in Beirut, so I'm kind of obligated to go back. But, you know, how long I do it, I don't know the answer to that. Obviously, I'm a journalist. This is the job I chose. And, and what I experienced was far less than other people experienced in either Israel or Lebanon. But you do wonder, you know, at what point the work does remain meaningful, and what point it becomes repetitive and you're not saying anything new.
You talked about limited means a number of times. Does working for the Washington Post mean that you have fewer resources than if you were working for AP or the New York Times?
You know, I've never found that a problem with the Post. It's obviously a smaller paper than the New York Times. It's in terms of infrastructure, it doesn't have what the Associated Press did, which is their place I worked for 10 years. But I found the Washington Post to be, I've always been struck by its, you know, I'm not saying this because I'm an employee, but I've been struck by the vision of its editors and their willingness to write stories in a different way, to understand stories and to see them in a different way. And I think that's a vision that showed through in this conflict. I think it's shown through in Iraq. It's something that does keep me very, very engaged with the paper, because I think there is something out there of trying to do journalism a little bit differently.
And when do you go back to Beirut?
Beirut, I head back next week, so about 10 more days.
Okay, be careful.
Thank you.
Anthony Shadid is the Washington Post Middle East correspondent from Beirut, and you might want to read his coverage of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, now available in paperback from Picador, called Night Draws Near. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
It's my pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.